Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as we often do, today I've invited my associate, Layla Mutin. She's the nutritionist at the Hoffman Center to help me field questions. Now, for many of you out there, judging by the feedback we've been getting on Facebook and via email, this is one of the most popular segments of our weekly broadcasts. Layla, you've got a lot of fans out there.
That's great to hear.
So anyway, you know, I'm used to breaking down some of these questions with you. It's kind of what we do in the office on a routine basis. For those of you who haven't heard Layla before, she's the nutritionist at the Hoffman Center. She's a registered dietitian, but she's gone on to advanced studies and has earned a master's degree in the field of nutrition. She's an experienced nutritionist. She first served under the late, great Dr. Robert Atkins, and has, how many years have you been with us at the Hoffman Center? I don't even remember.
Oh, since October 2005.
Oh my goodness, so we're talking now 8 years.
Yeah.
Right, going on, next month it'll be 8 years.
8 years, yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
You know, another significant milestone has occurred, and it slipped my mind, I didn't even realize it, but I was checking some of my calendars, and I was going back to the year 1988.
Oh,
and in September of 1988, that was the first broadcast of my radio program, 1988.
Wow.
So this means this is the silver anniversary, the 25th anniversary of my radio broadcasts. And, of course, Health Talk is still broadcast on a weekly basis on WOR Radio out of New York City, WR710.com for podcasts. And this Intelligent Medicine podcast, of course, is ancillary. It's the auxiliary source of information for all of those of you who've listened to me over the years. So I want to thank everyone. I want to thank the powers that be that have kept me on the air during a long radio career, and I want to thank my listeners. Oh, actually, it was fun this morning because I got out of the gym. And I started wearing my gym clothes, and I went to the open air market, which they have once a week outside. It's down by the United Nations where I live. And so this woman walked by me, and she smiled. And I don't know. My first reaction was, I checked my zipper to make sure. It's like one of those things where woman's smiling at me. Like, why is she smiling? Well, sure enough. A couple of minutes later, a few seconds later, she turned around, she came back to me, and she said, "Oh, you're Dr. Hoffman." And I said, "Okay, yeah, mostly when you're on radio, mostly people don't know what you look like, but somehow she knew what I look like. I'm not a TV personality like Dr. Oz or Andrew Weil." And she said, I just want to thank you because I've been listening to you all these years, and you've made a big difference in my life. And she looked slim and healthy, and she was headed for the gym.
Terrific.
So I thought that was kind of cool. So anyway. So
happy anniversary. That's absolutely
right.
Wonderful.
This is the September is the anniversary, and I don't know, we should do something. We'll get a bottle of champagne or something.
There you go.
All right. So we have, actually before we get to questions, I saw something interesting. I sent it to your attention, and I know that you are busily at work preparing for a seminar that you're going to present at the Hoffman Center next month, in the month of October. What's the date again?
It's Wednesday, October 23rd.
Okay, great. So what are the details? People can sign up?
Yeah, people can sign up. They should call our phone number to reserve their seat. That's 212-779-1744. Please do call by October 18 so we can reserve your seat. And the lecture is at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, October 23rd. All about how to Alzheimer's proof your brain.
Okay, now this, however, may seem a little weird to those of you who listen to the Intelligent Medicine podcast from afar, because I was also checking some statistics on these podcasts, and they've been very successful. We've had 25,000 downloads last month, and you can actually break it out geographically. So if you look at it, like 97% of our listeners are in the United States, okay, and then North America, so Canada included, that's the vast majority of people. But then there are a few individuals who listen to us from, get this, Israel and Japan and other parts of Asia. So that's pretty cool. So I just thought,
That's very cool.
Yeah. And by the way, and for those of you who are out there, and if English is your second language, this is an excellent way to build your medical vocabulary by listening to, and we try to speak, we try to speak grammatically here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. So, those of you out there, and you probably aren't going to be flying in to attend the Layla's lecture on October 23rd, but the subject is going to be Alzheimer's disease, and you're going into all facets of Alzheimer's disease. But I bet you never heard of this angle, and you're probably going to, now change your presentation to include it. Good hygiene may be to blame for soaring Alzheimer's disease rates. Go figure that out. Okay,
yeah.
Because this is the hygiene hypothesis. Tell us about the hygiene hypothesis, because you've talked about it in some of your lectures.
The hygiene hypothesis is about, because we are in a much better sanitized environment, maybe too clean, our immune system doesn't have enough to work against. And the hygiene hypothesis is generally saying that our immune system needs something to do, and if there is not enough bacteria, anything around for it to fight and keep those soldiers healthy, it will, its own tissues, as in autoimmune disease, it will cause allergy, as it does with an overstimulated immune system. And the hygiene hypothesis, even cases of asthma, it's hypothesized actually that, kids who grow up on farms around farm animals and dust and manure and hay and all this kind of stuff, all this kind of bacteria, are less prone to asthma as well as seasonal allergies because their immune systems become primed.
No, that's a good description of it.
Yeah.
And there's this old saying, idle hands are the devil's plaything.
Mm.
And, that's, I guess, a way to describe what the immune system does when it doesn't have anything to do, when there's lots of vaccinations, when sanitation is perfect. The immune system is idle, and it may turn against itself. So we may see allergies. We may also see autoimmune diseases. And there may be an autoimmune component to Alzheimer's disease. The brain tissue is being attacked by the immune system. That's at least one theory. Look, I'm not so sure this study holds water. They looked at dementia cases in 192 countries and found that it was more common in those with better sanitation and less disease. Okay. Well, we do know that, but, and we had a little conversation before we got in the air for the show, and you pointed out a very good critique of that, so why don't you have at it?
Yeah, the countries they looked at, and they're finding more Alzheimer's in more industrialized countries where the diet is much different than less industrialized countries, such as, and they compare to Kenya and Cambodia. Well, I don't know many Kenyans having McDonald's or a whole lot of pasta every day, drinking lots of fruit juice or soda or who knows what. So they're really looking at these cultures or these countries that where their diets are 180 degrees away from America or Western Europe, the countries that they compared it to.
Yeah, there's so many factors, pollution also and or exercise levels, leanness, because we're the fattest country in the world.
Yeah.
And, by the way, we have less germs, but, we also have a lot of obesity and insulin resistance. And I think you're probably going to focus less on this hygiene hypothesis than on dietary aspects of Alzheimer's disease.
I will bring it up, though, to clarify, what they looked at exactly and what the flaws of this may be.
Why not?
Although it's interesting.
Okay. Well, so that, look, the moral of the story is if your kid wants to get on the floor and crawl or wants to, pick something off, off the sidewalk, let him do it, right?
Just don't put it in your mouth if you're going to choke on it. We don't want choking hazards.
But germs are good. Who does?
No, the germs are good. Well, there are mothers who obsess and they're constantly cleaning the kids up too much and so forth. And
The old saying, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Chalk it up for that.
Yeah. I wish I'd had this information when I was growing up because I was really coddled. I always had to wash and clean. It's like I'd come in outside all covered with dirt and my mother would just go, "Oh my goodness!" and immediately, you know, draw
the
bathwater.
My mother is Mrs. Clean. You could eat off our floors.
Well, they may have inflicted grievous harm on us because of that. Okay. So little did they know. You know.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go to, actually, before we get to our regular questions, you know, there was somebody who sent us an email, and they must be a very careful reader of our website at drhoffman.com, because we have a bunch of articles posted up there, literally dozens and dozens of articles. And they read our article on thyroid, and they took umbrage at our suggestion that people who have low thyroid or hypothyroidism take carnitine. Carnitine is a heart-healthy nutrient. It's also something good for energy. And I see their point, because there is actually information that suggests that if you have hyperthyroidism, the opposite of low thyroid but overactive thyroid, that one of the things that can really help that and bring the thyroid under control, or at least ameliorate the effects of the hyperthyroidism, is carnitine. Carnitine could be very important for hyperthyroidism. However, this person was very, very adamant that we remove the carnitine suggestion from hypothyroidism so that we won't put people at risk of further lowering their thyroid. And you had a very
decisive
reaction. You took issue with that. And so why don't you share your impressions of that? Because originally, I think it was originally an article that you wrote saying that people with hypothyroidism could benefit from using carnitine, and you still defend that position.
Yes, yes. Well, here's the thing, and this is based on the study. What we're referring to here is Dr. Ben Venga, and his conclusion that he draws is, with hyperthyroidism and thyroid storm, excess thyroid hormones causing a lot of catabolism, muscle wasting, all of that.
That's Graves' disease.
Graves' disease. There's a disturbing amount of carnitine let go through the urine.
Mm-hmm.
And carnitine, we need that for our muscles.
It's like consumed or burned up. It's almost
burned
like
up. Exactly.
A car going over its capacity, and it burns a lot of oil. You know, I mean, if you drive a car at 100 miles an hour, the engine's going to heat up, and you'll burn up your oil in your crankcase.
Right. Well, what Dr. Ben Venga is stating here in his actual work is that this particular patient or subject who went through a couple of episodes of thyroid storm, but his actual symptoms were considerably milder during the attacks he suffered while taking supplemental carnitine.
Okay.
So carnitine is useful for the muscle energy at the very least.
Right.
Especially in catabolism.
It
works. The target tissue is muscle for carnitine, not in the thyroid itself, he says.
Yes, because people who take too much thyroid or who have hyperthyroidism, they have a lot of muscle weakness. They find it difficult to climb stairs. They find it impossible to do pull-ups because their muscles become very weak.
Mm-hmm.
And this is even though they're overstimulated. Okay, so conversely, now, can we thus conclude that, you know, you better watch out, because if you have a low thyroid and you take carnitine, it's going to further deplete your thyroid and slow it down?
No, because they also state in this particular research that carnitine does not have any effect on the thyroid gland's production of thyroid hormone.
Okay.
It's not working on the thyroid.
Okay, so
it's working on the muscles.
So it's sparing the muscles the overdrive phenomenon from the excess stimulation.
Yeah. Okay. It has no effect on the thyroid gland's production of thyroid hormones.
Okay.
And
so
I think that pretty much, you know.
I think that's reassuring news for the, you know, there's
people
taking carnitine, and
want
to make sure that we're not lowering their thyroid, but I think it's perfectly safe for the thyroid, even patients who have hypothyroidism.
I think a lot of people wrongly assume that if something works in one way, then the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do the opposite thing in science.
Right. Well,
biochemistry just doesn't work that way.
I actually have a good example of that. Is, for example, vitamin K. Vitamin K is something that can prevent blood from being too thin. If you don't have enough vitamin K, you have very thin blood. You cut yourself and you'll just bleed and bleed and bleed. So if you take vitamin K, it will restore your ability to clot. But a lot of people and a lot of doctors even believe that if you take excess vitamin K, it will cause your blood to clot.
Yeah.
It's actually a one-way phenomenon, just like the carnitine seems to be. It will restore your blood's ability to clot, but it's not going to make your blood thicker, give you a stroke or a heart attack or a blood clot in your leg.
Yes.
Okay, so that's an example of that, nutrition. Mm-hmm. All right, great. So let's move on to our actual questions. Do you have any? Do you want to run them by?
Yes, I have one from Sheila.
Okay.
She writes in, I seem to be accumulating fat in front and behind my armpits, that dreaded bra-strapped fat back.
Nothing has changed. I wouldn't know about that.
She says, nothing has changed in my diet, and I'm a 44-year-old female athlete.
Yeah.
Could this be hormonal?
Yeah.
Now, okay, may I start?
Did you suggest liposuction?
First of all, she's 44.
Okay.
We have to presume a little bit. She's probably perimenopausal.
Okay.
And some of the things that happen with perimenopause and as we approach menopause, we do become a little more insulin resistant, mm-hmm. a.k.a. carbohydrate intolerant. If she's a female athlete and she's doing things like Gatorade or having that bagel for the carbohydrate load and things like that, those things are going to start to work against us as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to find things like that bra strap fat back thing that happens. But there's another reason for that bra strap, that fat accumulation in the back besides insulin resistance. Women don't realize, and this is nothing about nutrition, women don't realize that they're change over time. It's not a stagnant thing.
We had a little dropout on our Skype line here.
The bra fat back syndrome is not just about insulin resistance, but it's also wearing the wrong bra size.
Okay.
Which is another phenomenon amongst us women.
Uh-huh.
We should be getting sized maybe twice a year, believe it or not.
Uh-huh.
So there's another thing. We get the fat rolls in the back from wearing the wrong size bra.
Okay.
And that can often be solved with a fitting.
Okay.
And it's miraculous, according to a lot of women.
Wow.
So there we go. That would be the other reason. But this fat accumulation in the armpit is also telltale of the cup size not being big enough, and it's pushing up that breast tissue.
Okay.
This is so completely out of my scope of practice, but I am a woman.
There you have it, folks. And now we don't offer fittings at the Hoffman Center.
No.
We only go so far. I mean, we will customize your nutrition program, but if you want a bra fitting, you know, we're not going to offer it. But that is useful and practical information. I had no idea.
Yeah, I think what Sheila needs to do is get refitted for a new bra size, especially a cup size, and then she will find, voila, that armpit fat that's being pushed up in front and behind will likely go away.
Maybe I should be thinking about a larger sized wife beater T-shirt, you know, when I walk around, you know, at home, because they, you know, when they're tight, they do compress the pectoral muscles. Oh, whatever. Whatever. You know, so I'm thinking like Marlon Brando in
Streetcar.
That whole thing. All right. All right, here's a question. Presuming you don't have any other questions right now.
No,
This one is, by the way, this person lives in Puerto Rico, so that gives you an idea of the extent of our listening audience. And she states, her name is Marie, I was impressed by your immense knowledge when I heard you talking about the chicharrón de Bayamón a while back. Now, this is a little bit of an in-joke for people who speak Spanish. I don't think everybody from Spain even knows what this is. It's a regional dish in Puerto Rico, and it's fried pork rinds, and it's the ultimate Atkins meal.
Oh, yum.
It's the no carbohydrates, but it's a lot of fat. And it's a real delicacy down in Puerto Rico. So I was kind of joking around and saying, you know, we're talking about low-carb diets. And I said, that doesn't mean you have to subsist on fried pork rinds, or as they call them in Puerto Rico, chicharrón de Bayamón. Okay. So anyway. So the question is, hi, Dr. Hoffman. I'm a longtime listener and love your podcast and newsletter. Thank you for the valuable information you provide us. I have a question regarding my 30-year-old son. He's been suffering for a few years from bacterial scalp folliculitis and has treated it with limited success with shampoos and the like. He was recently put on doxycycline 100 milligrams 2 times daily for a month. The condition has improved, but he is afraid that when he stops taking the antibiotic, it will come back. She also mentions he has mild Crohn's disease, which he controls pretty well with diet. And he's presently taking Dr. Ahir's probiotics to minimize the antibiotics' effect on the gut. Okay, so, I mean, here's a guy who has, I mean, what is folliculitis? Well, these are boils. They're, you know, it's not just, you know, acne, but actual boils in the scalp. And that's going to be very painful. And in addition, he has the condition Crohn's disease. So that makes me suspect that something's a little bit funky with his immune system overall. His ability to recognize and fight off harmful bacteria is impaired. And so, you know, we actually have patients who come to us. Remember, we've had a few specifically with the condition folliculitis. That's all they have.
Yeah.
Some of them actually have a very serious condition called MRSA or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, mm-hmm. and the conventional antibiotics don't work anymore. So what we've done with them is we've, you know, basically strengthened their immune system, modified their diet. So what can you say about that?
Well, to strengthen the immune system, first of all, any and all sugar is known to suppress the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the first thing. And I wonder, you know, if he has mild Crohn's disease, I wonder what kind of diet he's controlling it with. I wonder if he's on the specific carbohydrate diet, which is very, very helpful.
Yeah, that's
but
a
even
dynamite
if he's doing,
for the Crohn's
yeah,
disease.
Even if he's doing the specific carbohydrate diet, I would go easy on the fruit juice, even the fruit a little bit, if he's suffering with folliculitis,
mm-hmm.
you know, just to help out his immune system.
And some of the specific nutrients that might make an impact on his immune defense?
Oh, well, definitely the probiotics. Certainly zinc, vitamin C, especially for skin, zinc and vitamin
mm-hmm.
C.
Mm-hmm.
He would benefit from Empower.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, the mushrooms. He would benefit from Transfer Factor.
Right. And I'm thinking vitamin D might be very important, too. Because
oh, absolutely.
There's actually studies that show that people have a better resistance to infections when they have adequate levels of vitamin D. And patients with Crohn's disease, in my experience, are notorious for having low levels of vitamin D. Vitamin D also helps control Crohn's disease. So I would really highlight checking vitamin D levels and making sure that they're not just to avoid malnutrition, but high normal to
right.
help fight infection. Also, there are some studies that suggest that low iron is associated with folliculitis, and certainly if you have an intestinal disorder like Crohn's disease, you may malabsorb iron. So studies say that replenishing iron can help fight infection. On the other hand, too much iron can actually suppress immunity, so you have to be careful.
Right, iron, too much iron can actually feed infection. Yeah.
So, in terms of natural antibiotics, sometimes we give our patients, you know about this, right?
Yeah, olive leaf.
Olive leaf, oregano.
Mm-hmm.
There's a product we use called oregacillin, which has actually been demonstrated to work great against strep and staph. It really seems to eradicate these bacteria, even when antibiotics fail to work. So there's some natural things in our arsenal that can be used to suppress, I mean, it's like natural antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that would be, you know, I mean, long distance, you know, maybe there's some things that you can try, Marie. And thanks for listening to us down there in Puerto Rico. All right, so let's take a look at our next question. And that comes to us from Cheryl. Cheryl writes, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman, love your show and listen to the podcast all the time. I have a friend that just bought a boatload of krill oil." That's an interesting image. A boatload of krill oil.
Oh.
"And I was not able to tell him which is best, or would it be good to take both?" I guess both. She probably means both krill oil and omega-3 fish oil. Oh, in the subject line of her email is krill oil versus omega-3. Would appreciate help on this. Thank you much. And Cheryl's also a Facebook friend. So
what do you think?
Well, what I think, I mean, here, you know, I think we've discussed this in the office is, you know, should we put our patients on krill oil? And I'm not against krill oil. I just think that krill oil is a little bit oversold. Krill oil is a source of omega-3, and it does have some additional ingredients, particularly astaxanthin. Astaxanthin is a reddish pigment that's part of the carotenoid family. It's related to beta carotene, mm-hmm. and it seems to have protective effects. It may be beneficial, but it's one of those things that's in vogue these days, and I'm not sure that the studies are that robust in support of astaxanthin as a panacea for all kinds of health problems, as is claimed. And the other thing about krill oil, it's less concentrated than our fish oil capsules, so you get less EPA and less DHA, which are the active ingredients in omega-3 fish oil. It is stated, but not proven by the proponents of krill oil, that it is somehow more bioavailable, that it goes to where it needs to go better than fish oil. But also, that has not been that well established either. It seems to be more of a claim rather than an established fact. So I'm okay with krill oil because I think it's probably healthy. But right now, we both of us rely on a product called Orthomega, which mm-hmm. is a very high-quality fish oil.
Absolutely. Orthomega is a great product. Also, eat lots of wild Alaskan salmon. Eat sardines as well. High omega-3s there. Notice I didn't say tuna because tuna is also full of mercury.
Right.
But Orthomega is a wonderful product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for the kids, little kids, sometimes they don't like these big capsules. Sometimes people say they get fishy taste or repeating on them. So we give them a product called Core Omega. That's an emulsified fish oil, which actually tastes really good. And if you start kids on it, they'll actually ask for it. And it'll help their brains, it'll help their academic performance, it'll help to ward off attention deficit disorder.
It will also help them to behave.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a much very stabilizing effect
wonderful.
On behavior. Yeah. Because, I have to say, I was tough to tackle when I was a kid. And I know my parents were, because they had me evaluated a couple of times. And in retrospect, I think they were evaluating me, and this is in the 50s, to see if I was normal, if I needed help, if I had to go to military school or something like that.
Oh, no.
And I had absolutely no omega-3 fatty acids in my system. I didn't eat any fish. I was very, very finicky. And I think I really could have benefited from that when I was a kid.
You were finicky.
I was finicky.
Wow.
Here I am, renowned nutritionist, medical mm-hmm. nutrition guru. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, there were times when all I would eat were, hot dogs and Hostess Twinkies,
Well, that's a kid's diet, too, and,
yeah.
Parents didn't know in the 50s that that's not real food or anything. And
so,
Twinkies are back, apparently.
Twinkies, it's a retro thing. All right, this one is addressed to both of us.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Dr. Ahman and Layla, what are both of your takes on an article and brochure that I read that states that the four tocopherols, this is about vitamin E, the four tocopherols should not be mixed or be taken at the same time with the four tocotrienols. Okay, so let's, a little science here. Vitamin E is actually a broad rubric for a variety of related compounds. There are four tocopherols that belong to the vitamin E family, and there are four tocotrienols. And the tocopherols are alpha, gamma, delta, and there's one more. I don't remember right now. And there's all kinds of different tocotrienols. So the tocotrienols have health benefits. They're present in natural vitamin E that you might get from nuts or an avocado.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it comes in nature. So, yeah, we believe in providing people with a broad spectrum product. Our vitamin E products always have mixed tocopherols and tocotrienols together. However, and you actually asked me to answer this question because you didn't really have a strong opinion. They say it's suggested one should be taken away from the other, that you should take the tocotrienols away from the tocopherols. Now, I have heard that, but I'm just not sure that there's a lot of science backing that up. It is thought that, by the way, the tocotrienols seem to be particularly effective for lowering cholesterol, and if you take high doses of them, they will have a beneficial effect on cholesterol. Some people don't even believe this.
Why an avocado is so good, yeah.
Right, and we know that people who consume in the Mediterranean diet a lot of nuts and avocados have better heart health. That may be part of the equation.
Dr. Hoffman, the trouble I have with this, the separation, is what do we do when it comes down to the food we eat?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in nature, that's not the way it is.
Yeah.
They're actually bundled together.
Yeah. That's really the only my only objection to, you know, what's being suggested here.
Yeah, so, I mean, I have to say, there are things that sometimes are said by wonky nutritionists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have just that this is the way it's got to be, is that you have to take your calcium 6 hours away from your magnesium, because otherwise it just won't do you any good. And it stuff like that just makes people nuts. And yes, there is some competition and maybe potentially some interference, but there's so much in nutrition that is controversial, that is still under investigation, that is unresolved, that these rules are just not hard and fast. Some people place a lot of faith in them, and it gets them really obsessive and worried about, you know, am I taking the right thing at the right time? And, you know, people have a little, you know, reminders, and they have like schedules for how they're going to take things during the day. I'm not sure that it matters all that much.
Yeah, I agree. I would agree. Yeah.
So, you know, and besides, I mean, the vast majority of people can't comply with all these very, very complicated and sophisticated rules. So, you know, we try to make it doable. I mean, life is complicated enough without having to take, you know, stage your vitamins, you know, 8 to 10 different times per day.
Mm.
Okay. That being said, okay, Patricia, this is an interesting question, and I didn't understand it at first. It's from, it's actually from Bob. Bob is using, I guess, his wife's account, so it's actually from Bob. Why does blood pressure rise dramatically while sleeping? Thank you for answering this question. Now, my initial response when I read this, as might be yours, Layla, is blood pressure doesn't really rise dramatically while you're sleeping. When you're sleeping, you're relaxed. I didn't know that blood pressure really rose while you're sleeping.
No, and especially lying down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is, in general, not the case. But then I thought to myself, there is a kernel of truth to this. And in fact, there is a condition which some people get, which is actually a very dangerous condition, which is sleep apnea. We're hearing more and more about sleep apnea. And in apnea, when you go to sleep, you snore loudly. And if you observe someone who has sleep apnea, they actually have I'm trying to make the sound of like gasping, you know, breathing pauses, where actually the brain deoxygenates in a dangerous way. And what that does is it sets off an alarm in the body, and it encourages the production of cortisol and adrenaline, which are stress hormones. And so when you wake up in the morning, you feel like you've been in a, you know, heavyweight prize fight. You know, you feel like you've done, 15 rounds with Muhammad Ali, because you're so stressed out from the sleep experience. But in addition, it may actually increase your risk of stroke or heart attack. And I once had a patient who mystified me. I had no idea why he had such high blood pressure, because he was eating a superb diet. He was exercising. His weight was great. I asked him about stress in his life, and he was very relaxed and calm. But his wife came to the office with him on one visit, and I just thought, I turned to her and I said, "Does he snore?" And she just rolled her eyes, and she said, I have to sleep in another room. He doesn't just snore. He brings the house down. And so we did a study on this gentleman. And he had very profound sleep apnea. He had many interruptions of sleep. And this is partially what drove his blood pressure up, because he was having this stressful sleep experience, because, you know, there's nothing like suffocating to send your blood pressure up. So I think that's what's underlying Bob's question.
Sounds right. That sounds right. Yeah, sleep apnea. That would be.
So what, you know, while we're discussing sleep apnea, you know, is there a nutritional strategy for sleep apnea?
Well, after getting the CPAP, and he probably has sleep apnea because he may be overweight.
Mm-hmm,
so that would be my first, you know,
first thing.
Assess.
First thing.
Yeah. And especially if he's got a lot of fat accumulation, as men do, in the torso, up in the neck, all of that.
You,
is,
if, you've
is
got
also,
a, if you've got a shirt size, you know, men go, when you buy shirts, you know, you buy it by sleeve size and shirt size. If you've got a shirt size that's above 17 or 17 and a half, you've got a lot of fat around your neck, and you know, it could be muscle. I mean, you could be you know, a tight end for you know, the boss for the New England Patriots. But if you're an ordinary guy and you've got a neck size 17, 18, or above, very high likelihood of sleep apnea. And simply by losing weight, it's going to abate. Now, perhaps 10, 20% of sleep apnea occurs in very slim, trim individuals, and it has to do with the structure of the throat.
That's true, too. Yeah.
And some dysfunction of the tongue muscles and the epiglottal muscles. There's a whole science to this. But simply losing weight is helpful. And for some people, it's a matter of allergy because they get very congested and mucousy, and that causes them to have to gasp and have difficulty sleeping. And sometimes getting off something like dairy or wheat will actually alleviate this. So I think Dr. Atkins used to talk about this, is people who had daytime drowsiness, maybe due to sleep apnea, if they went on a very low-carb diet and got rid of wheat, they would do a lot better.
They would do a lot better. The other thing, again, not nutritionally oriented, sometimes the muscles in the throat, that whole area, can be, you know, take up playing the trumpet or the English horn.
Mm-hmm.
There's another horn instrument from Australia. I don't remember the name of it, but
the
it tends to tighten and strengthen.
Wait, the didgeridoo.
Yes, that's it.
That crazy
yes,
sound.
Yes, that might help snoring. You know, besides the weight loss, but it's also toning for those particular muscles.
Or singing, you know, potentially like you know, vocal control.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
But the removal of food allergies or food intolerances absolutely is helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's consider Kevin's question. I think this is a follow-up question. He sends it to you. Dear Layla, continuing on the high blood sugar question from your last podcast, what is the best way to lower blood sugar and what supplements are helpful?
Oh, yes. And if that person gets our newsletter, I talked about some of the supplements for lowering blood sugar, besides going on a low-carb diet.
By the way, mention the newsletter, because for some of our podcast listeners, they're not aware of our newsletter, and it's great. And this week you wrote about what?
I wrote about blood sugar.
Okay,
yeah, that particular question I addressed even further.
Right, and I wrote about the BMI, the body mass index, and the lack of accuracy of the body mass index in my article. And I talked about something new called the ABC, which is the a new body size index, which is a new way of calculating whether you're at risk of dying based on height, weight, and your waist circumference. Radio program at AOL.com is the way you get our newsletter. Just email us to radioprogram@AOL.com. And this month we're completely redoing our website, and there probably will be a little place to click. So if you know, wait for a couple of weeks, check out our website at drhoffman.com and click on the send me the newsletter link and we'll get it out to you.
And if anybody has any questions, they can submit their question to radioprogram@AOL.com as well. So we welcome all of your questions.
That's the way we get our questions.
Yep.
Or, you know, sometimes via Facebook mostly via radioprogram@AOL.com. All right, so let's tackle the question of the supplements. I know you answered that in the newsletter.
The supplements that I prefer, not necessarily all at once or in any order, we like chromium, certainly. We like a product called Diaxanol, which contains chromium in it as well. We like CM Core, berberine, is terrific. It's like metformin. It's like a natural form of glucophage. And it's wonderful for insulin resistance and unstable blood sugar. Certainly benefiting from a lower carbohydrate diet is the first order of business. Olive leaf also helps to lower blood sugar. Olive leaf is good for so many things. Blood sugar, blood probial, antibacterial, all kinds of things. Olive leaf is very, very good for. Those are my particular favorites.
And then there's also, did we mention Gymnema sylvestri?
Gymnema, yes.
Yeah. What's the
Which
product
is
we use?
Beta Fast.
We have a product called Beta Fast, and this is on the principle that some people need a little support for their pancreas so that they can cover their blood sugar. You know, the pancreas makes insulin, and Gymnema in Ayurvedic medicine is sometimes referred to as the sugar destroyer. It actually they had diabetes even in ancient times in India. I guess the upper classes or the leisure class could afford enough food to develop diabetes, and there's a high rate of diabetes in South Asia. And so they use the herb gymnema, which they called sugar destroyer, as part of Ayurvedic medicine in their arsenal against diabetes. So that could be helpful.
Yep.
So, okay, great. So anything else that we want to talk about in today's broadcast? Oh, let's mention that many of the products that we refer to here on Intelligent Medicine are available at drhoffman.com. We have a dispensary there. It's for the benefit of our patients, but also for our listeners. Just click on the store at drhoffman.com and browse the products that are there. If you obtain your products through us, we have a price guarantee where if you see a product, you may think, well, this is a very boutique-y website. Everything's going to cost twice as much as at a discount website. Well, think again, because if you find the very self-same product, I mean, these products that we stock there are very high quality. We only want the best products for our patients and our listeners. So they can be a little more expensive than discount products. But if you find the self-same product elsewhere on the Internet for cheaper, we'll match the price. So that's available to you as an Intelligent Medicine podcast listener, and it's a great resource, and we have lots of great product descriptions. You can find out about some of the things that we talk about on a routine basis. So, Layla, it's extraordinarily hot here in New York. We're experiencing an early fall hot spell.
Yeah.
How many degrees? I barely left the house today. How many degrees was it?
I think it's 88 degrees, something like that. It's very, very humid. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it always seems to happen at the time of the Jewish holidays, doesn't it?
Does it?
Yeah. I mean, there's something about the Jewish holidays where it gets really hot and humid, and you're going to synagogue and you're wearing a suit, you know, and it's just really, it's always very oppressive. All right. So let's then reconvene. Mm-hmm. We'll try and do this again next week. And Layla is a frequent guest and contributor here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. And thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.